Good morning, everybody. And if it's not morning for you, where you might be, I'm glad you're here. Good day. Thank you for joining us. Isn't it nice to welcome people into this Sangha? And of course, welcoming yourself, even if you haven't been here for a long time, coming back over and over again. We just keep doing this. We just keep doing this because this sense of belonging. Not just the sense of belonging, the actual belonging is essential, I think, to our well-being. It is essential to being able to wake up every day and be in our lives with all of the complexities and know that there's a refuge, a ground where in to which we get rooted. That's how it feels to me. So, I didn't say I am calling in today from the ancestral land of the Wiat in the tiny little town of McKinleyville, California, about 300 miles north of Spirit Rock on the coast in the Redwoods. The sun is out, which makes me very happy. Makes me very happy indeed that the sun is shining. So, how our morning will go is, we'll move right into a meditation. We'll have about a half an hour sit. I'll offer a lightly guided meditation. And then we'll have time to check in with each other about practice. I'll offer a Dharma talk, plenty of time to ask questions, share your own inspiration, your own awareness, whatever comments, reflections based on what I'll offer. And I want to say that no matter where you are coming from in your heart, no matter what kind of expression of your practice you have, whatever meditation practice you find most nurturing, let that be real. Let that be okay. Because there's not one way to cultivate awareness, compassion, wisdom from the ground of non-harming, which is the root of this practice. So there isn't one way. I will offer some instruction around the breath and around the body and basic awareness. But if you have a meditation practice that you know that is what works for you, do that. So take what I offer, try it on, let whatever resonates be here, and let the rest go. And to that end, I recently came across this really great short little poem from Naomi Shihab Nye. It's called If the Shoe Doesn't Fit. If the shoe doesn't fit, you take it off. Of course you take it off. It doesn't worry you. It isn't your shoe. Isn't that great? How often do we struggle with trying to fit ourselves into somewhere that we know isn't maybe quite right for us, to be someone we're not? What if we just say, this shoe doesn't fit? It isn't a problem. If the shoe doesn't fit, you take it off. Of course you take it off. It doesn't worry you. It isn't your shoe. I just love that. I think it's just going to go with me everywhere. It doesn't mean you don't try it on, right? You try stuff on, and we know intuitively, oh, that feels really good. That feels really good. I'm going to do this. But when it doesn't, don't do it. Because there's no gold star in causing more dukkha or getting blisters, if we want to just play with that metaphor. Okay, everybody, let's move into a meditation. Find a posture that works really well for you, whether you're seated, whether you're standing, whether you're reclining. Maybe you're even choosing walking meditation for this period. Welcome yourself into this sangha of all of us who come from different places but have some like-mindedness, some like-heartedness. Let your eyes close if you like, or have a gentle, soft gaze down. Maybe on the next inhale, let the shoulders rise towards the ears. And on the exhale, let the shoulders relax and soften down and melt a little bit. Noticing the places your body is connected to whatever it's touching. Your seat, your feet, perhaps the hands. Just noticing those touch points. Maybe there's a sense of pressure. The sense of touch, what is that actually like? Maybe even notice the places where the body is touching itself, the eyelids, the tongue in the mouth, the lips. The insides of the upper arms gently touching the sides of the torso. And then noticing the breath. Nothing special to do at all. Just breathe and know you're breathing. Being aware of the inhale, aware of the exhale, breath after breath. You might even notice a place in the body where you feel your breath the most. Could be anywhere. Could be the belly, the chest, the shoulders, the nostrils. And you might not feel or sense your breath predominantly anywhere, but you do know you're breathing. And letting that be enough. Becoming aware of sound. There may be sounds around you that are quite dominant or not, but simply bringing awareness to hearing. Maybe sounds further away or right close. To become fully present in this body, with this breath, sound. And then there's the state of mind, the thoughts that come and go, the state of heart, the energies that also come and go, leave their mark. So finding that place that makes the most sense for you to place your attention within this greater space of awareness. And just hang out there, Not too tight, not too loose. Settled attention. And when the mind floats somewhere else and you know it, it's actually a very important moment of knowing where you are, here or there. And then come back to this point of attention and begin again. And we'll sit quietly. If you're noticing anywhere in the body that may be holding some habitual constriction or tension, send a little softening energy to that place, inviting it to open and relax a little bit. For me, it's often my jaw. It gets tight without me even knowing it until I know it and intentionally scan through the body with some caring energy. Give that a try. Whatever's happening in the mind, imagine softening all of the edges of the mind so thoughts just flow through. They arise, they hang out, they might take you away with them, and they dissipate, yet you're still right here, letting the quiet that's emerging be at the forefront of your awareness, this steadiness, the stillness, just being here. From this very quiet place, and from wherever you are, within this steady body, the breath coming and going, the heart beating, thoughts coming and going, imagine expanding out as if you're on the very top of a mountain, or maybe in an airplane, a 30,000 foot view to this very broad, big awareness. The steadiness that you have cultivated right here is right here, which allows for this big, more open awareness of everything that comes and goes. Yet your awareness, your attention is steady, your body, your presence is steady. See if you can hang out in this more open awareness of everything that goes on. Yet you are not shaken by it. You just hear, witnessing thoughts, emotions, hearing sounds, noticing sensations, all of it. Here in the middleness, steady, this word, tatramajatata, just here. This expansive, quiet place. And if it's too wobbly, come back to the breath, but give this a try. And then drawing the awareness back in and bringing it into the space of the heart. Becoming aware of the heart center, maybe even placing a hand or two on the chest to get a sense of this space, the warmth of the body touching itself. If your hand is on the chest, maybe noticing the movement with the inhale and the exhale, the expansion of the chest as it relaxes back. Breathing into this heart space from all directions, nourishing the entire heart space. And breathing out, back out into every direction, the peace that you cultivate, the steadiness that you cultivate through this commitment to be here. The nourishing breath comes in, the receiving, the offering breath goes out, giving back, offering. nourishing breath comes in. And you may also choose to imagine releasing anything that would be helpful for you to send out, something you don't need or an offering. This heart's breath. And knowing that this beautiful practice of awareness, steadiness, sitting still, being still, the courage to be here with whatever shows up is such an important, poignant practice of presence. So we send out the goodness of our hearts to all those around us who may need a little support. It includes ourselves. And here is a poem called Mending the Tattered Web of My Heart, the World. It came out of the Wee Moon catalog many years ago. I am mending the tattered web of my heart, the world, with plush emerald yarn of compassion and generosity. I darn holes torn by blame and judgment with soft and sturdy strands of kindness and understanding. May I repair jagged rips torn by despair and grief with braided grasses of gratitude and deep purple reeds of acceptance of things as they are. And where anger and fear burned gaping holes, may I reweave with golden threads of forgiveness, gleaming copper cords of courage, and strong silver strands of trust in the mysterious and holy unfolding of what is greater than I can know. To strengthen this web of my heart, the world, I send out these healing threads to anyone who needs them, anyone at all. And from Eddie Hillesum, who said, ultimately, we have just one moral duty, to reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves, more and more peace, and to reflect it towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will also be in our troubled world. Welcome back, everybody. I am glad you're here. And this is a time that's really sweet if you turn your video on, if you can. I know not everybody can, but I like feeling like I'm in the room with you and that I can actually see you. It's just nice. It's just really nice to do that. And I will make two other announcements also at Spirit Rock. On May 26th, so it's a little bit a ways from here, Sylvia and I are offering both an in-person, a hybrid retreat. And so you can come, if you are local, you can come to Spirit Rock. It's going to be a beautiful Sunday. It's Memorial Day weekend. And it's a day actually to lift all of our spirits. It's really a day to be together, to really feel the uplift that we can feel even in the midst of difficulty, to practice heart practices together, to just be together. You can come online if you'd like to come online. It's from 10 to 3, and Sylvia and I will both be there. And the information is both on the Spirit Rock website and on Pacific Mindfulness website. But all the registration is through Spirit Rock. So I'm excited about that. I haven't been to Spirit Rock on Land to teach for a while. I've been there to sit my own retreats, but mostly I'm teaching online. So I'm pretty excited about that. I think it's going to be really, really nice to be there. And then the other thing, I have a very big request for everybody. As you know, this class is offered on a sliding scale. It's offered as in the Donna model, and we really need your help. We really need you to know that your contributions are essential for the ongoing support of this class, for Spirit Rock, for the teachers. So to take seriously that when you offer fees, they actually really matter. They really, really matter. So thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, so there's one more thing I want to ask you before we dive into the Dharma talk. And this is also, just like we share the metta, I like to open up a space in each class to talk about meditation practice itself, because oftentimes it can just get glossed over. You know, we have a sit, we talk about our hearts, we talk concepts, Buddhist concepts, we talk about practice, but I'm wondering if anybody has any questions or reflections on what happened in your meditation. If you'd like to share that, if you have any questions about it, or if there's some ongoing stumbling block that you're finding in meditation itself. Gwen, lead us off, please. Thank you.
I'm just completing this last Living Dharma program. Uh-huh. And when we did Right Mindfulness this last month, I was introduced for the first time to the concept of internal, external, and the combination of internal, external. And the questions that keep arising for me is that a question around where your awareness intention lies when you sit in meditation? Or is there a willfulness in this that I'm missing? And it keeps popping up.
Yeah, so it's a good question because it keeps popping up. Okay, so the Buddha taught in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness to cultivate internal awareness. What is happening internally? And you might take that from experience it through the various senses. What you notice hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling. That's one way of experiencing internal awareness, even though, you know, some of those are external. There's the internal awareness of heart energies, the movements of the mind. The pleasant, the unpleasant, for sure, because all of us know what pleasant and unpleasant, or even a little neutral, a little unpleasant might be like in the body, in the heart. So in the mind, pleasant thought, unpleasant thought, etc. Right? Are you with me, Gwen? You're mm-hmm. on this. Okay. So to know what is present is the practice, without the commentary of it should or shouldn't be there, because that's extra.
Yeah.
All the conditioning that goes on top of whether it should or shouldn't be there, but really the practice of this is what is arising now. This is what is here. Then externally, sound might be external for sure, right? Temperature might be external. It could be that the temperature of the room is external to the internal experience of it. Or it could be the external experience of walking into a room where there's a lot of joy. You walk in and there's just, it's really lovely. What it feels really good. And noticing in the presence of external joy, what happens internally with that? And then the awareness of both, internal and external awareness, in the presence of contact with anything. This is where we go to with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Whatever we experience, there is a quality of somewhere along that big continuum line of extremely pleasant to extremely unpleasant. It happens in a pre-verbal place. You come into a room or whatever it is, you look at something, there's a message that gets sent internally. I like it or I don't like it. It's pleasant or doesn't. I mean, this is just how it is for everybody. And that place that's sort of meh, you know, neutral, usually there's a little tinge of pleasant or unpleasant. But how we are in relationship to what's happening internally in response to external is that place that we find adaptation, accommodation, acclimation. Sorry about the helicopter noise. So to be in relationship with whatever is happening, that is the right mindfulness, or the skillful mindfulness, the wise mindfulness that has that ability to say, this is what is happening outside of me. My internal experience of that, and what is my relationship to that? And the relationship to that is more than one thing. There is the pleasant, unpleasant. There are the voices of should and shouldn't. There's all the conditioning around that. But the mindfulness says none of it is in and of itself a problem. It's what's here, which opens up this space of choice, which I think really is what our practice is about. This is what's happening. How am I going to respond? The way we transform reactivity into responsiveness. Is that a helpful, really long answer?
Really, really helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah, you're welcome. My pleasure. Anybody else? Questions on meditation? Questions on this practice of what happened in meditation? Christy, please.
Hello.
Hello.
So what I'm experiencing lately is a very, it's not unpleasant. It's like halfway between unpleasant and neutral to like this very like aggravation, very like low level underlying aggravation. And I've just found myself sitting with it. And that feels like there should be maybe another step aside from just kind of sitting with it and being with it every single day.
Yeah. So what does it feel like in your body?
Oh gosh. Like, you know, like ant bites.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's really great that you can actually describe, oh, ant bites.
Just
so it's
low level of aggravation that's just there, but doesn't necessarily go away. And I'm not sure how to be more, I'm not sure how to, I either work with it or aside from just sitting next to it and befriending it.
I think that that's pretty wise because in time it will change. And so being with the annoyance that it's still there, if that's what's there, aggravated by the aggravation, or maybe is it getting in the way of other things? I mean, like, is it clouding your experience?
Not necessarily. I mean, and I guess in life, it's making me more patient with the small things that are happening every single day. But I just feel like in my meditation, I wish that there were a practice or a focus that I could do to maybe work with the origins, or not just with, because I'm working with the sensation and it's kind of not a part of any story that I can come up with at the moment.
So that's actually really important, that maybe it isn't a part of some story, but it's there. And why it's there may be less important than the presence of it. So are you familiar with a practice called shift and stay? So this is something you might try, and I think when I describe it, it will be familiar to you. So here's this ant bite sensation that is there, and is it more obvious when you're in meditation than when you're not?
Yes, because life is full of distractions.
Exactly. Yeah. So when usually when we get quiet and sit in meditation, whatever's here gets louder because we get a little quieter. So if you can find a place, and this is a physical suggestion, a place in your body that's comfortable, that actually might not have ant bite sensation, and just do scan down, and maybe there is a place. It might be very small, might be fingernails, you know, it could be really, really small. Maybe it's larger and you hadn't noticed, but to place your attention somewhere where that isn't the prevalent sensation and stay there. And then if you can stay there, it shifts the attention and the ant bites can keep going, but they become, the volume gets turned down on it. So you're shifting your awareness from the thing that's the loudest voice, maybe the most prevalent sensation, to something that's quieter and letting that get a little louder. Letting that be a little more predominant.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And then you can take it and you can swing back and forth if you want to try it. You go to that place where you're shifting and staying, where it actually is okay, and hang out there. And in the hanging out there, you might name, well, what does this sensation feel like? This sensation of non-ant bite. Like not toothache, right? If we took the toothache analogy. So what does non-pain, non-annoyance, non-aggravation, what is that actually like? And describe that to yourself.
That's a great question.
I know. I mean, and there may not be a ready answer for it, but that is that question that says, what else is true? So you go to that place of, oh, the tip of my elbow is completely neutral, maybe even a little warm. It's not a problem. And placing the awareness in the tip of the elbow. And then, if you feel like it, letting in the ant bite sensation. Notice it. Notice where it is. Notice the level of it. And then go back to the neutral place. Go back to the elbow. Hang out there. And the reason for doing this is to be able to see that the ant bite isn't the only story, which I know you already know that, but you might notice how the sensation and aggravation and presence of ant bite starts to shift also. So when you said, I know it's not always going to be there, but it may be morphing and changing all the time anyway. So it helps to loosen up the grip about, I know it's not always going to be there, but it's here. And it is, you know, it's not going away. And I think to let yourself off the hook of not needing to figure out why it's there. Because in the wanting to figure out why, it's such a typical thing. Because if I know why, then I can do something about it and this discomfort will go away. But come back to that question that I think is really, really important around any level of suffering. Instead of what is this suffering about, where is this suffering leading? Because this is a flavor of dukkha.
Yeah. You write that down.
Yeah. All right, let me know how it goes.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so we don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to start this Dharma talk because I'll be here next week and we can keep going on it. So I am not going to be, I'm not going to have any kind of difficult feeling about, oh my God, we didn't stay on schedule, because this is our practice. This is what we are doing together. This is a lifeline of it's more important to talk with each other about what are you learning and how can we all learn together than it is for me to just talk. So, and I get the value of both. I know why we're all here also, but this is really important. So last time I was here, a couple weeks ago, I was talking about the paramis of truthfulness and metta as paths of awakening. And I think everything we talk about is a path towards awakening, this deeper and deeper understanding of how things are. And today, you know, with the upset that is in the world, with these vast protests on college campuses, I'm bringing this in because it is what is happening. And if we want to cultivate awareness with the present, it includes what is happening in our world and how do we make sense of it. As I was reading, I've been reading a lot about these protests and where they are and the variations from campus to campus. And there was a picture the other day that I saw of like a permanent installation somewhere of words on a stone wall. And the words said, "Everything will be okay." And then below it, somebody had written this very long paper banner and hung it up. And it said, "If we speak up when they're not." So then everything will be okay got expanded to if we speak up when they are not. And it really moved me because it brings in so many parts of our practice. How do we speak up? When do we speak up? What is the proper timing? I want to say from the beginning, I don't have the answer to this, but this is what I'm thinking about and looking to what the Buddha has taught to our practice to help me reconcile my own discomfort with the violence that is in the world, in whatever form it takes. So how do we make sense of what's actually happening on campuses? Can we listen? Can we feel whatever we might feel about it? And so it brought me back to W.E.B. Du Bois, the great intellectual, sociologist, activist, the co-founder of the NAACP in 1909. And famously, at age 89, he said, "I've been wrestling with four questions all of my life, and every generation has to come to terms with these questions. How does integrity face oppression? How does integrity face oppression? What does honesty do in the face of deception? What does honesty do in the face of deception? What does decency do in the face of insult? What does decency do in the face of insult? And how does virtue meet brute force? How does virtue meet brute force?" So these questions about integrity, honesty, decency, virtue, they're all variants of sila, of ethical and moral behavior, supported by wisdom, supported by compassion and bravery to deeply consider what is to be in integrity or integra. Think about the root of that word, integra, integral, that which holds things together. Decency and honesty and virtue. So I've been thinking about this. And it brought me back to Mahagosananda, who was a Buddhist monk who led the rebuilding of Theravada Buddhism in Cambodia and calling for peace and reconciliation after the overthrow of the Khmer Rouge in 1979. He was known as the Cambodian Gandhi because he walked across the country teaching metta, forgiving those who had harmed his own family, who he lost in entirety in the 5-year civil war in Cambodia in the 70s. And he was able to forgive those who were responsible for the murder of his entire family. And he said that he does not question that loving one's oppressors may be the most difficult attitude to achieve. But it's the law of the universe that retaliation, hatred, and revenge only continue the cycle. And so in my own distress around the violence that is everywhere, and in particular, as I'm reading about the protests, and they're in my community too. I'm in Arcata, California, and Cal Poly Humboldt is there's a lot going on there. A lot of people were arrested last night. The part that's very hard for me is not the protest itself, because I think voices really need to be heard, but it's the destruction that is happening at the same time. The destruction of the property, the harm that is being caused to the community, others around, the integrity of the education. How can voices of dissent be heard in a way that it can be heard? And this is so much of what our practice is. How do we say what is true without causing more harm? And it's very difficult in the face of fear, outrage, all of it. So Mahagosananda was famous for saying, the thought becomes the word becomes the deed becomes the habit, and the habit hardens into character. So watch the thoughts with care, let them spring from care for all beings. As the shadow follows the body, so our words follow us, like the sun following the clouds. So let's take this apart. The thought becomes the word. It does. It does. You know, all kinds of thoughts come in here, and some things we say and some things we don't. Think before you speak. We all know these things. The word becomes the deed. So we get the thought, we might say something and follow it with an action. But if we keep doing that same thing over and over again with the same kinds of thoughts, the same kinds of things that we say, and then a certain action, and we do it over and over again, it becomes a habit. And habits do develop our character the more we do the same thing. So to know the difference about the wholesome thought, the unwholesome thought, the thought, like what are the thoughts we have that we actually verbalize? What are the ones that we have that we say, actually, I'm not going to say that. That we actually know, I shouldn't say that. And I imagine there isn't anybody among us who doesn't get ignoble thoughts. Of course we do. We live in a tough world. And there's a lot of should and shouldn't. There's a lot of fear and outrage and all of this. But it really does make sense to pause, to use this practice of mindfulness to say, well, wait a minute, that was a really snarky thought. What is going to be the consequence of me saying that? And obviously there are degrees to which, you know, that the discourse, the snarky thought and the hateful thought, there's a really big difference. So this is a practice that brings us into an intimate relationship with what is happening in our minds, the thoughts, how it affects the hearts, and what we do. So the internal awareness, here comes the fearful thought, here comes the angry thought, to be able to know, oh, this is what it feels like in the body. My heart is racing. The pull to do something, to act, is there. What does rage actually feel like in the body? Is there shutting down? You know, for many, there's a numbing out because the intensity of what's around us is overwhelming. In the presence of overwhelm, there can be a shutting down. There can be an extreme acting out. But this practice is inviting, if not demanding, a transformation of reactivity into responsiveness. Over and over and over again, this is what we want to know the difference. And reactivity being the lightning fast judgment and impulse of action that isn't rooted in care, that might be with the intention to cause harm. Because without the skill of, oh, I'm hurting. Oh, I'm frightened. Oh, I'm outraged. To be able to know that experience and then to pause enough to say, all right, what is the wisest response here? Instead of, I'm going to go burn down that building. That's the self-control. That's the discipline that I think we're being asked to bring in here. And I'm not saying that, I mean, there's some pretty impressive things going on some campuses around nonviolent protest. And that's impressive that people have the wherewithal and the capacity, the patience, the insight to say, I'm just going to be here. I mean, look what John Lewis did. You know, when John Lewis said, sometimes it's necessary to make your voice heard through the body, we're going to sit here, but we're not going to cause harm. We're not going to deface the property. We're not going to, you know what I'm saying here. And this is why the first foundation of mindfulness, what is this like in my body? What is it like in my breath? What am I noticing? And the second foundation of mindfulness, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, to notice, oh, I'm in this space and I'm frightened. How am I going to behave with that? Or I'm in this space, I feel great, I feel really safe. That expanse of safety to unsafety, a lot happens in there, right? When we don't feel safe, that is where a lot of reactivity, unskillful action can happen. But what I think this practice is asking us to do is to become zones of safety. Zone of safety in myself that says, I'm not going to do anything intentionally to harm myself. And because I value you as much as me, I'm not going to do anything to intentionally harm you. So it requires a lot of discipline, a lot of discipline, a lot of pausing to say, what is the best mode of action here? So what I'm pointing to, and you probably know, is the teaching of the two arrows, which is a foundational teaching that the Buddha gave us. And just to briefly give you this, what the Buddha said is there's a difference between practitioners and non-practitioners. I want to be careful with that because I'm not holding us up as practitioners as so holy and that we don't get it wrong, because we do. But there are different kinds of people, people who understand this teaching and are working with it, and people who may have never heard about it before. I'm just going to take a little tangent here on this before I keep going. I used to row a lot on Humboldt Bay. I really love rowing. And I was out one morning early with some friends in a single boat sculling. And we were out on the bay and we were stopping and talking. The other two people I was with were talking about when they had fallen in. And the water's cold. You know, it's like you don't really want to, this is not a warm area where I live. And they were talking about their experiences of falling in the bay. And I very naively said, I haven't fallen in. I was so ridiculous. And they said to me, yeah, well, there are two kinds of rowers, those who have fallen in and those who haven't fallen in yet. And I was definitely put in my place about, yeah, okay, right, I am human too. And I kid you not, the next time I came down to row, I was getting in the boat right off the dock and I fell in right there in all my dry clothes, right getting onto the boat. And it was just, of course that happened. So this thing about the two arrows, it says that those who are learning about this and those who haven't started learning about this yet, this is what we're talking about. To live a life means we are going to experience pain. That's obvious, right? First noble truth, whether it's mental pain, emotional pain, physical pain, spiritual pain, is part and parcel to living this life. What we do with the pain is the key. So for a person who hasn't yet learned this, Typically, the automatic response when one receives something painful is to shoot the next pain out. So that what the Buddha was saying about this natural pain we all experience is like getting shot with an arrow. We're all going to receive that arrow. But do we shoot an arrow back, or do we say, ouch, that hurt? We train in saying, ouch, that hurt, instead of shooting an arrow back or five arrows back, whole quiver. And, you know, we're looking around, we're seeing what's happening with the shooting of the arrows. So we can make a vow that says the violence stops with me. I know I will receive pain living this life, but I want to be careful how I respond to that. I don't want to hurt you back. And sometimes I'm going to do that. Sometimes I'm going to blow it. And I am going to do that. But I want to learn from that. And I don't want to be too terribly hard on myself when I get it wrong. Because we are. We're going to. But more and more we don't. And that's the beauty of the practice. More and more we say, ouch. Okay. So, we come to this very ancient teaching, hatred never ceases by hatred. By love alone, it is healed. Yeah, right, to Viv's point, oh, when ill will is starting to have its way with me, I remember to go to metta. Because that's the key here, is may I be at ease, may you be at ease. You know, one of the practices I use to shift from fear and anger, or maybe anticipatory anxiety, is I imagine breathing in ease and breathing out peace. Breathe in ease and breathe out peace. And what that does for me is it helps me re-regulate my nervous system when I'm scared, or when I feel anger, when I am agitated, anxious. I literally imagine breathing in ease, breathing out peace. And I don't have to say five or four metta phrases that start with may I. You can, and that's a very beautiful practice, but usually it's just a word or two that, because you already know the practice, that you go, oh yeah, metta. I mean, it might be for Viv that, oh, metta, I'm there. I'm there. It is just the reminder of the practice because we have so much muscle memory. And if you're new to the practice, you will gain it. You can rest assured, you will gain it. Because, as this quote that's attributed to Gandhi, an eye for an eye will leave the whole world blind. Yeah. And this is the issue that I am struggling with protests that cause harm. It's really right to raise your voice, to say, wait, this is wrong. But we don't justify violence in response to violence, in my view. And I think that is what these teachings of nonviolence say. So this leads us to practices of radical responsibility. And I can't even begin. We're going to start with this next week because we got 10 minutes left. And I think what I want to do is read you a story, and then we're going to talk with each other. And then next week, we're going to talk about, this is interesting, there are what are named in Buddhist practice as the two guardians of the world that help us stay on track. The Pali words are hiri and otapa, which the literal translation, which is so cringy to me, is moral shame and moral dread. Like, what does that even mean? It means self-respect and social conscience. That's what we're talking about, that leads to this quality of radical responsibility. So we'll talk more about that next week. But I want to read you a story. Okay, hang on. So here's the story. This comes from a man whose name was Terry Dobson. Terry has been not of his body for a long time. Maybe he's been gone 20 years. I don't really know, but a long time. And this is, an accounting of an experience that he had. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives and their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that she was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled toward the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that on his hands they were cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I'd been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. Trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid the chimpira, the pinball punks who lounged around the train stations. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself, getting to my feet. People are in danger, and if I don't do something fast, they will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized a chance to focus his rage. Aha, he roared, a foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered, you're going to get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A split second before he could move, someone shouted, hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left. The drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had the most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here, the old man said in an easy vernacular, beckoning to the drunk. Come here and talk with me, he waved his hand lightly. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, why the hell should I talk to you? The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved as much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. What you been drinking? He asked, the eyes sparkling with interest. I've been drinking sake, the laborer bellowed back, and it's none of your business, flecks of spittle spattering the old man. Okay, that's wonderful, the old man said. Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it out into the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My great-grandfather planted that tree, and we worry about whether it will recover from those ice storms we had last winter. Our tree had done better than I expected, though, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. It's gratifying to watch when we take our sake out into the evening. even when it rains. And he looked up at the laborer, eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fists slowly unclenched. Yeah, he said, I love persimmons too. His voice trailed off. Yes, said the old man, smiling, and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife. No, replied the laborer, my wife died. Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself. Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically, my, my, that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it. I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. I would have to practice the art with an entirely different spirit. It would be a long time before I could speak about the resolution of conflict. So, we need to watch our minds. We need to be cognizant of our actions. What when we do it is for the welfare of ourselves and others, the Buddha said. How to learn to raise our voice appropriately. Wise expression. Everything is going to be okay if we speak up when they are not. Such a big thing to explore what that means. Tom, let's go to you, and then we have to finish.
I just wanted to say the story was just beautiful, and it literally moved me to tears.
Oh, it started well up. Yeah.
And then it dawned on me that this story has the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path all right there. It's a tremendous Dharma lesson. All in just that story. And I hope I remembered.
If you send me an email, I'll send it to you. Send me a note and I'm happy to send it to you so you have it. But you're right. And this is the beauty of storytelling, that we could each probably write a story of our own lives that would exemplify the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Paramis, all of it. Yeah. Because those teachings are all about what is it like to live a life, and that I'm not sure how I want to say, what I want to say with this, like that realization that the man has at the end of, oh, I have a lot to learn about what reconciliation is, what love is, when reactivity calms down, when we go from ill will to compassion, so much is possible. And it's all right there. You're entirely right. The whole thing is in there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the Buddha could have told that story himself.
That's right. And so can we, because we have Buddha nature in us. And that's why I said, you know, I think we can each find a story in our own lives that exemplifies this. And that we have the possibility to heal and to wake up. That is what is in this. So thank you everybody for hanging out a little bit late, a few minutes late. Carlita, thank you for all of your support. Thank you to everybody. I hope you'll come back next week. I will be here next week. I'd love to see you. And let's just offer up the goodness of our efforts. So to all beings, may all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. Thank you, everybody. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.